So we're actually using the last time for that?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. I thought it was after the class.
No, no, no. We never have more time than after the class. So, two-thirds of the class is going to continue, of this lecture is going to be on file systems, a continuation of where we left off last time, and the last third we will do a review for exam 2. Okay, so let's start with file system. This is the picture I put up last time. Okay, so I said this is the file system component in the kernel. Okay, layered bottom is at the very bottom you have the hardware. In this case we are just looking at disks, but it could be any storage device, USB disks, CD-ROMs, SSD drives, solid state drives, magnetic drives, tape drives, doesn't matter, but it's all storage devices. Then you have the low layer, so at the very top your applications, and then what sits in between is what is inside the kernel. So there are two layers in there. This is the interface that the kernel is exporting to application. This is the file system interface for accessing any storage data. And then you have the lower level interface that allows the kernel to actually read or write data to storage devices. Okay, so we last time we spent a little bit of time talking about this file system interface. Okay, open, close, how do you read a file, write a file. We looked at this notion of directories and so on. Okay, today we are going to look at the lower level interface. I'm going to start with how disks work. Okay, and then we look at how storage should be organized on disks. Okay, as far as some of the actual interface is concerned, we will wait until we start looking at I/O devices, because that is material that is also part of device drivers. Okay, so we want to actually look at how the kernel is communicating with your disk over a SATA or a SCSI bus or anything like that today. Okay, so this is what we will start with. So let's start with an understanding of how disks work. Okay, so I presume you know a little bit about this, but if not, I will explain in more detail. Okay, so I got some disks just to show you. If you haven't seen what a hard disk looks like, so this is a typical hard disk that is in a PC class device. Okay, 3.5 inch disk, and I'll talk about what is inside this disk. Okay, but that's what it looks like. If you have a laptop, then you have a disk that's smaller. And this is essentially the same thing, but a 2.5 inch disk. Okay, I believe it's either 2 or 2.5. Yeah, it's 2.5 inch disk. Okay, so you see that it's shrunk quite a bit. Okay, and if you have a solid state disk, that's what you have in iPods and iPads, I can't open this. It's even smaller. Okay? You can probably see this through the bubble wrap, but it's even smaller than this, 1.8 inch. Okay? So you'll see that the form factor is actually shrinking. Okay? The technology has also changed. Okay? So these are traditional magnetic disk drives, and I'll show you, this is a picture of it here. These are solid state disks, no moving parts. Okay? This is like your SD card that you stick into a camera or a tablet or a phone. Okay? Same technology is now in disk drives. Okay, so let's try to understand what disks look like on the inside. Okay, so the best way to explain it is what is in this disk is essentially very similar to what you see on a CD or a DVD. Okay, so you have what are called platters. Okay, so each platter looks like a CD. Okay, and data is recorded on those platters, and this is basically how data is organized on a platter of a disk. Okay, typically what you see if you actually open this up. Right now you have to unscrew this, so I'm not going to do that. You will see that there may be 8 to 10 of these platters. So think of it as a stack of DVDs or CDs that are actually stacked in there. Each of that is a recording surface, each of that can store data. Okay? But as far as each surface is concerned, it looks somewhat like what a CD or is organized somewhat like what a CD or DVD is organized. So you have what are called data is recorded in circles in here. Okay, so each of this circle is called a track. Okay, not to be confused with music tracks, these are data tracks. Okay, so a track is where you store bits, and each track is partitioned into sectors. Okay, so each of these things is called a sector. Okay, a sector is the smallest unit of data that you can read or write from a disk or a CD. Okay, you cannot read any bits that are smaller than that. So typical sector sizes may be 512 bytes in size. Okay, so that's the minimum amount of data that you can read or write. And the way you actually go about reading or writing is there is a disk head. Okay, so I should have gotten a CD to illustrate this. But let's assume that you have a platter. Yeah, I think you have to assume this is a circle. And you have a disk head, and this thing is spinning. Okay, the whole platter is actually spinning. There's a motor that spins it, and the disk head can position, it moves back and forth, and it can position itself to on any track. Okay, so this disk head can move back and forth, and this thing is spinning, and it positions itself on any track. And then when the right sector spins under the head, it can read or write. Okay? So the way you actually read or write this to this device is you say, tell the disk, go to track 35 and read sector 15. And then what the disk head will do is it will see where it's positioned and then move back and forth until it goes to track 35. Once it's positioned on that track, it has to wait for the right sector to spin underneath the track. And once it's underneath the head, and once the right sector is positioned under it, and as it spins by, you read or write bits to it. Okay? It's important to understand how disks work, because we will come back and see how to optimize the layout of data as far as the file system is concerned, how to optimize the layout of data on these disks. So a few things you should consider, remember, is that the data is organized into concentric circles. Okay? Each circle is referred to as a track, and then tracks are partitioned into sectors. Yeah, and then basically that's the minimum granularity of data that you can read or write to a magnetic disk. Okay? This is how traditional disk drives work. As far as if you switch to solid state disks, completely different technology. We'll come back to solid state disks next time, or maybe the class after, when we talk about RAID, we'll talk about all these other technologies. Okay? But this is how disks have worked for a long time. Okay? That is changing, and soon you probably won't see any of these disks as SSDs take over. But for now, we still have to worry about it. Okay? So now, if you try to think about reading or writing data, there is going to be some overhead. So we have kept saying disks are slow. Okay? We said memory is fast, disks are slow. You have to ask, why is that? Okay? So let's try to understand that. So as I said, if you want to read any sector from this disk, you have to first take the disk head and move it to the right location. That is the right track. Okay? And then you have to wait for the disk head, the right sector, to spin underneath the head, and then you can read or write. Okay? So what this says is there is going to be always an overhead to do an I/O to disk, which means there's going to be a latency incurred before any useful work can happen. And there are two kinds of overheads. The first one is referred to as the seek time, and the second overhead is what is called a rotational latency. Okay, I'll draw a picture here so I don't have to keep going back and forth. Okay, let's assume that's the disk head. Okay, and this is the track you're interested in reading. Okay, maybe you want to read that chunk. Okay, this is the disk head at this point. Okay. So first you have to move this disk head. So this disk head moves back and forth, and this splatter is spinning. Okay. So the first latency, the seek time, is the time that takes this disk head to move itself and position itself on the right track. So it is going to move forward, and eventually it is going to arrive at the right track. Okay. And this latency is referred to as the seek time. Okay, the time to position the disk head over the right cylinder or track. Okay, for this class, they are synonymous. Okay? And once you have positioned it on the right track, you are still not done. Okay? The data you are trying to read is here, but the disk head is positioned here. So you have to wait for the entire platter to spin so that this data actually appears here. Okay, and then once it is positioned and it's spinning by, you can read. Okay, that's the rotational latency, the time for the correct sector to rotate under the disk head. Okay? Until this point, nothing useful has happened. You're just trying to position the disk so that it can do some useful work. Okay? Typical latencies for these seek times and rotational latencies are in the orders of a few milliseconds or tens of milliseconds. Okay, it's not unusual to have a 10 millisecond seek and a 10 millisecond rotational latency. Okay? So for each I/O operation, if you are paying tens of milliseconds of overhead just to get the disk to the right location, nothing useful has happened in the meantime. And that's a long time, as you can imagine. compare that to a quantum duration of 100 milliseconds. Okay? You are wasting 10-20% of an entire time slice in just doing I/O. Well, you won't be running on the CPU, but you can see where the overheads come from, why disk is slow. Okay? Compare that to memory speeds, which are in the order of micro or nanoseconds. Here we are talking on millisecond overheads. Okay, 1000 times higher overheads. Okay? And once you have positioned the disk, then you can read or write, and the speed at which you can read or write is dependent on the speed of the interface. Whether it's a SATA interface or a SCSI interface or a USB disk drive will depend, will govern what is the speed at which you can actually read data off the track and send it to the machine. Okay, so all of the file system optimizations that we are going to study are going to try to lay out data on disk so that we reduce these overheads. Okay? The more seek and rotational latency overheads you are going to incur, the worse your performance is going to be. Okay? Because as I said, that's wasted time. You are not doing any useful reading or writing. You are just positioning the disk. Okay? So if you come out with intelligent layout on disk, layout of data on disk, so that this overhead is minimized, you are going to see better I/O performance. Okay? So all of the file system material that we are going to look at today is going to worry about how do you optimize this overhead. Okay, is that clear? Okay. Now I'm going to just say one more thing here before moving on. So all of these optimizations that we'll see are valid for magnetic disk drives. Okay, these are the disk drives where the platters are spinning and so on. If you actually switch to solid state disk, none of these overheads exist. A solid state disk is effectively a random access device. There's no moving part here. You just directly address blocks, saying give me block 25 and you just read block 25. This is exactly like your address memory. You can just say go to this location in memory, this address in memory, and read a word from there. Same kind of stuff. So file systems that you have designed to for or optimized for magnetic disks don't necessarily perform well when you switch to solid state disk. Okay, you actually have to change the underlying layout because the technology has changed. Okay, so you will see the file systems will work fine, but the optimizations won't buy you anything because they are not meant for this technology. Okay, so keep that in mind. So all of the optimizations are only valid for traditional magnetic disks, not for solid state disks. Okay, so this is another picture of what I was just saying already. So this is what is inside a disk. As I said, it's a sequence of platters. There's one head per platter. Okay, this head moves back and forth. All the platters are spinning. At any given time, you can actually read or write from one of the platters. Okay, you can't read or write in parallel. That's not allowed because there's only one bus going on. So you can pick any of these platters and position your head on the right track on that platter and the right sector and read or write from that location. Okay? So the way you are going to address the disk is you are going to say go to platter I, track J, sector K. Okay, so that you will pick one of these platters and then you will pick a track on that platter and you pick a sector on that track. And this is how you are going to address do I/O on disks. Okay, anything that I can clarify before we move on? This is just a brief primer on how disks work, the hardware stuff. Okay, so now that's why basically we have to talk about file system. So let's move back to what a file system is. So as far as the file system is concerned, okay, it actually doesn't know anything about the layout on disk yet. Okay, the way it is addressing data is it's using logical addresses. Just as we had logical memory addresses and physical memory addresses, the same kind of concept is true here. So basically you will have file numbers and blocks within a file. So as far as the file system is concerned, it will say go to file 10 and read the 15th block of that file. Okay? Somewhere you have to keep some data, some tables that map files and blocks to particular sectors on disk. You have to say, okay, file 0 block 1 maps to platter 4 cylinder 3 sector 8. Okay, cylinder is same as a track. So this mapping has to be maintained somewhere. Okay? So if once you know that, and if you get a read request for this block, the device driver will actually translate that to a read request for that sector on disk. Okay, this is the translation you will do from the file layer to the underlying disk. Now, as far as file system performance is concerned, last time, if you remember, I talked about sequential and random access. We need a layout on disk that will allow us to provide good performance for applications that are accessing files in sequence as well as ones that access data randomly on disk. Okay? And we want to ask the question, what is the right data structure to maintain file information and how do we lay out these files on disk? Okay, so we'll talk about that one at a time. Okay. So first of all, what we have to understand is, as far as the file system is concerned, there are two key aspects that the file system needs to worry about, which is what we'll call data and metadata. Okay, so data is what is actually the files themselves, what is in the files. Metadata is additional bookkeeping information that the file system maintains about each file. Okay, ownership of the file, what's the size of the file, where are the blocks of the file stored on disk, all of that information for each file is stored in what's called a metadata for each file. Okay, so here the metadata we'll refer to as the file descriptor. Okay, and they have been given different names. In Unix file systems, they are called inodes. Okay, in some other file system, they have been given different, and we'll use a generic term, which is a file descriptor, for referring to metadata. Okay? So we have to worry about what is the structure we use for the file descriptor, and what is in the file descriptor, how does it track where the files are stored, and so on and so forth. Okay? That's the first thing. The second issue that we need to worry about as far as file systems are concerned is the types of files you are going to see on a disk. Okay. If you take a typical PC or a laptop and examine the actual files that are stored on that disk, you will see the following characteristics. Okay. You will see that most files are small. Okay. The average size of a typical file on disk is a few kilobytes, 3 to 4 kilobytes. Okay. So most files are small. The majority of files are very small. The majority of the disk space is taken by a very small number of very large files. Okay. This is also called heavy-tailed behavior, if you heard the term heavy-tail. Okay, so most of the space taken by a very small number of files. So you may have large music files, or you may have created a video file, or you may have lots of images you've taken on a camera. Those are consuming most of the space, but those are a relatively small number of the total files. You may have up to 100,000 files on a typical disk. Okay? Your media files, in this case those are the large files, are probably a small fraction in terms of overall number. But in terms of overall space, they consume most of the space. Okay? Most files are small, most disk space is taken by large files. You want to support I/O operations on both small and large files. Okay? Whether it's a Java program you wrote that's 3 kilobytes in size, or a 1 hour DVD video that you downloaded and are viewing, you want to provide efficient access to both. Okay? So the per file cost must be low, but large files must also have good performance. Okay? So now, you have to design a file system that can accommodate all of these characteristics. Okay, by file system we mean you need to design what the file descriptor looks like, what the layout on disk looks like for each file. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay. So we'll start with some simple file system, then we'll build it up from there. Okay. So the first one is, we'll do the same stuff we did in memory allocation. So we'll say, let's assume that files are stored contiguously on disk. Okay. So what does that mean? So the OS or the file system maintains a list of free blocks or free sectors. Wherever you want to create a new file, you basically take a contiguous chunk of sectors and you say, this is where this file is going to be stored. Okay. So as far as this platter is concerned, let's say you want to store 1 kilobyte file, each sector is half a KB, 512 bytes, you're going to find two contiguous free sector and say, this is where the file is going to be stored. That's the first block or the first sector of the file, that's the second block of the file. Okay? And that's it. So files are contiguous and you basically have to maintain a free list of all the sectors and find enough contiguous sectors to accommodate that file, and you're done as far as this file system is concerned. Okay, so as far as the file descriptor is concerned, all you need to do is store two bits of information in addition to the file name and ownership and so on. What you will have to do is the start location and the size. Yeah, so file descriptor says this file foo, okay, starts at this track and this sector number, and it's two sectors in size. Okay, so that's all you need to do to track down that file. So if you have a editor that says, oh, open this file, you just look at the start location, that's the start address on disk, and the size, and you know where the file is stored, you read the whole thing. Okay, very simple policy. Okay. Now, advantage, as I said, very simple. So you can ask, okay, what is the overhead of accessing this file? Okay, if I send in a request to read the whole file, what kind of seeks and rotational latency overhead am I going to see?
Okay.
Yes, I am asking.
Probably one seek and one rotation. Obviously.
Yes, we had something else.
No.
So to read this entire file, the overheads are going to be, you say go to the start location of the file, so you are going to seek to that track, and then you are going to say wait for the start location to spin by, and then just read I sectors, and I is the size of the number of blocks in the file. Okay? So one seek, one rotation, and then some number of sectors, okay, that's the transfer time. So that's basically the access overhead of this kind of organization on this. There are many disadvantages, of course. First is, files are not going to be static. Okay? Files will grow and shrink. You are writing some source code, you may add some text, you may delete some text, the size of the file keeps fluctuating. If you have contiguous allocation, you have the same problem. If you then put another file right next to it, and this file grows, then you have no space, then you have to copy that data somewhere else, and that increases the overhead. Okay. So changing file sizes poses a problem, okay, and you have fragmentation again. Okay. So you are back to the fragmentation problem, because files are of different sizes. As you create and delete files, you will leave holes on disk, and you have fragmentation. You may have external fragmentation where there are lots of holes, but no hole is big enough to accommodate a large file. Okay. So those are the disadvantages. Now, as it turns out, although this might seem like a very naive approach, it is widely used, even today. Okay? And the reason it is widely used is there are certain classes of disks where it works out okay. These are write-only disks, write-once. Write-only doesn't make any sense. Write-once, if you just write, don't read, that doesn't. It should be write-once, read many disks. Okay? Namely, CDs and DVDs. Okay. These are what things that you are going to burn. The file size doesn't change on a DVD. Once you burn the DVD or CD, you are done. Okay. So if you want to burn a CD or DVD, you take all the files, you lay them out contiguously, and you just burn the thing, and you are done. Okay. After that, you don't have to. Nothing is going to change for you. Okay. And this is as good as it gets. It's very simple. There's not much organizational stuff to deal with. You only have to say this file begins at this location. That's the size of the file, and you just read it contiguously. Okay, so it's still widely used for us. So if you have any CD-ROM, DVD, the file system there basically uses this organization. Okay, now needless to say, early operating systems use this organization no longer, because this doesn't work for general purpose disks. Okay, but for special cases like write once, read many, worm devices, okay, so this works fine. Okay, that was the first approach. Second approach is linked files. Okay, so basically what you do is you keep a list of free sectors. Okay, so you say these are all the sectors on the disk. Files are no longer have to be contiguous. We are going to make a files as linked list on a disk. Okay, so basically you say this is the file descriptor. Okay, you keep a pointer to the head. Okay, the pointer basically says the first block of the disk of the file is platter 4 cylinder 20 sector file. That is this data block. Okay. And then you store some data and you keep the last byte as a pointer to the next chunk of the file, the next sector, and so on and so forth. Okay. So you have an address to the next block here, and that's data in the file, that's the second block, and then you have an address and so on. So it's really a linked list, okay, as far as the file is concerned. And the file descriptor only has to store the head of the list and the size of the linked list, namely how many blocks there are. Data doesn't have to be contiguous, okay, because you can just have linked list, and this blocks or sectors can be spread anywhere on disk. So So you have one sector here, it will have a pointer to another one there. So you have another sector here, it may have a pointer here, and so on. Okay. Alright, so let's try to understand what are the pros and cons of this organization. Yes.
Well, you're going to have to seek one time for each sector. In the worst case, you have to seek once for each block of data you read, and you may have to rotate for each block
okay.
of data. So if it's scattered, if these are scattered all over the disk, we may have to have a seek through different track and then a rotational rate for each block.
Right.
And if I want, this may be kind of an edge case, but if I want to just read in the last block of data, I can't do that because I only have a pointer at the beginning of the file, so I have to go track down all of the other blocks of data before I can figure out where the last one is. So if I just want the last, you know, 500 lines of that 20 megabyte log file, I have to go read the rest of the thing anyway.
Okay. So you have something to add to that?
It's also a growing problem because if you have a file that you write to contiguously, like the log file, it'll eventually scatter itself all across the drive.
Okay. So file is scattered. Access is slow.
Fragmentation of these standard block size.
Okay. So one advantage, people don't like it, one person likes it. Yeah, so no external fragmentation. So clearly external fragmentation is gone because the data doesn't have to be contiguously laid out. You can just find any free sector. If you want to grow the file, find some free sector somewhere and just put a pointer in the last block to that block and you have added one block to the file. Okay? Files can grow and shrink without having to be contiguous. External fragmentation gone. Okay? The caveat, as was mentioned, is this size of this block has to be either a sector or some multiples of a sector. Okay, let's assume it's just one sector. Okay? No external fragmentation. Right? Good advantage. Disadvantage, as was pointed out, to read this file. Okay? To read, so if you look at the contiguous allocation, it said to read it, you have to do one seek, one rotational latency, and then you just read the next n sectors which are stored contiguously. Okay? Now, if you have an n block file, here you will potentially have n seeks. N rotational latencies and N transfers. Okay. Because each of this is stored at different locations, so you will go and say seek to this block, and then you will move the head there, you will read it, and you will say where is the next block. You will actually take this pointer, say now seek to this block. Okay. So that each of these blocks is going to trigger a seek and then and rotational latency over it. Okay. And as I said, seeks and rotational latencies are wasted overhead. Okay, so we have significantly increased the overhead just to read the file sequentially. Okay, so sequential performance is significantly slower than contiguous allocation. And that, as was pointed out, random performance is even worse. If you just say, go read the ith block, that's the only block I care about. Okay, you don't know the address of the ith block, you only know the address of the first block. So you actually have to traverse this linked list to actually get to the nth block. You have to read all this data, and the further out this block is, the more data you are reading. So you are actually traversing the linked list until you get to the ith block. Okay? So essentially random access is a sequential scan. Okay? Not good from a performance perspective. Yes, question.
Where is the linked list stored?
Where is the linked list stored? This is what is actually stored on disk.
Okay.
Right? This is a block on disk. The last byte of that block is actually a pointer. It stores the address. This address is actually stored in the last byte of that block, in the sector. So you now know the address of the next block. This is, so if it's a 512 bytes, think of this 511 bytes of data, one byte metadata which stores pointers.
So there's no like abstraction of this stored in like cache?
There is no cache. This is what is on disk. Okay, once you read the data in cache, you can cache it in memory and so on. But reading it is going to be slow. Yes. Okay. So random performance is not great. Okay. Now, so again, as I said, although this might look like a naive organization, there are file systems that use this. Okay. DOS had file systems or early FAT file systems actually use this organization. Okay, so basically there used to be a linked list. Okay, some versions of FAT still do some variant of this. So random performance is random access rather is has bad performance. Sequential access is not bad, but it has n seeks, one seek per block that you need to read. Okay. So we already answered all of this. Fragmentation is gone. File size changes easily handled. You can insert blocks in the middle by tweaking pointers at the end and so on. Efficiently supports, well, it's not efficient, but it supports sequential access with n seeks and n rotation. Random access is not directly supported. You have to essentially scan in order to get to a particular block. Number of seeks we already talked about. Okay? FAT file systems use this organization. Okay? The only good part of this is the entire free blocks on the file is essentially one large file that looks exactly the same as any other file. Okay, so if you want to keep a list of all the free blocks on disk, all you have to do is create one long linked list of all the free sectors. Okay? So if you want to then get a new free block, you just go to the head of the list, take this is a free block. You just basically take it out of this free block file and then move the head to the next one. You have to delete a file, you take that entire file and just put it at the beginning of this list. Okay? So deletions and growing files are not bad because the free block is also has the same organization as valid files on this, the free block list. Okay? Any questions on this? Yes.
So if you put all of the free space into a linked list, is the arrangement of that space arbitrary or is it sequential?
Okay, that's a good question. If you put it on that linked list, is the arrangement arbitrary or sequential? Over time, it is going to become arbitrary. You can do recompaction where you reorganize this because it might be the case that two sectors, adjacent sectors are both free, but because they were assigned to different file, one sector is at the beginning of this list and the other one at the end. So even though you may have two adjacent sectors, you can't even do simple optimizations like put two sectors next to one another in the same file, which may actually save you one seek when you try to read adjacent blocks, for instance. So over time, this list will get fragmented, but you can of course defragment it by re-sorting all the blocks in the free list. That might give you some better performance. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So what the other thing I should mention is the reason sometimes you can undelete files on once you delete files, but if you run some utilities, they can undelete files. Is many a time the file is actually not deleted. You just take it from the file descriptor and just stick it onto the free list. The entire linked list is still preserved. It's just sitting there on the free list. Yes, if you want to undelete it, you can actually go and look at what is in the file and just take that chunk of that section of the linked list and take it out and restore your file. Okay, this is how some file restoration utilities used to work. Yes, question.
So when you delete the file descriptor, the pointer is still there in the linked list?
When you delete the file descriptor, you just wipe this out and you just zero this out. But this entire linked list is just gone. You take it and you stick it on the free block list. So all the data is still there. You don't erase the data. So if you actually go and figure out that those are the blocks of the file, you can recover the file. Yeah, because the structure is intact. Unless you have already allocated some portions of those sectors to other files, it will still be sitting there. You can undelete it. Okay. So neither of these organizations actually we really like. Contiguous allocation only works well for CDs, not for general purpose file system. This organization, not great for random access. Okay, so we need a better one. So we are going to use indexed organization, okay, so which is indexed files. So here what we have is a file descriptor, which is a table of pointers. Okay, so let's say this table has 10 entries. Just for as an example, the first entry has the address of the first block, the second entry has the address of the second block, third entry has the address of the third block and so on. Okay. So when you open the file, you first read this file descriptor. Okay. And then you basically, if you want to access the ith block, you just look at the ith entry, you get the address and you go read it. So essentially this is a table of disk pointers, not memory pointers, this is a table of disk pointers. Each So these are addresses of disk blocks. These are, so the ith entry here points to the ith block on disk for that file. Is that clear? Yes. So this index, the reason you call this index files is basically this is an index of disk pointers. And in Unix terminology, this is called, this file descriptor is called an index node for this very reason, because it stores the index of disk block pointers. Okay, so now if you understand this, let's ask the question, what can we say about the performance of this organization and pros and cons? Yes, we have something to say. Okay, N seeks and N rotational delays. Yes, you had something else.
I was going to say that, but also that, but you do get good random access performance here.
Okay. So, for sequential access, you basically just look at the first block, send off an IO request for that address, look at the second. So, and since the blocks no longer have to be contiguous, like in the linked list, blocks are not contiguous, blocks will be scattered on disk, you will have N seeks and N rotational latencies, okay, to read N blocks of a file. Okay. But unlike the linked list organization, random access is efficient because the address of the ith block is in the file descriptor. It's not actually in the file itself. Okay, so you just look at the ith entry here and you know the address and you just go read it. Okay, so to read the ith block, you have basically two disk IOs. The first one to read the file descriptor, and the second one to read the block once you read the ith entry. Okay? Yes.
But the primary disadvantage would be it must be a declared file size before it's created and potentially can't grow.
Yes.
So couldn't you just make the last pointer point to another index node?
Okay. Good point. So I was going to say, what about files growing and shrinking? So as you can imagine, okay, the number of entries in this file index determines the size of the file. If there are I entries, you can have I blocks in the file. Okay? Because, I mean, you can only store addresses of I disk blocks. If you want, if the file grows to I plus 1, this organization by itself won't handle it. You have to somehow make this organization dynamic. Okay? So either you say, I limit the size of the file to N blocks, and N can be a large number, and for every file I allocate a descriptor with N entries. Okay, let's say N is 1000 blocks, and I basically every time I create a file, I create a file descriptor in an array of 1000 entries. Okay, and then basically I can accommodate this maximum file size that I've declared upfront. If you want to make the file bigger than that, it won't grow to that any bigger. Okay, but the disadvantage of it is twofold. The first one is, of course, as I said, most files are small. They are a few kilobytes in size. So you may have a very large file descriptor with mostly empty entries. Okay, so you're wasting disk space to store large empty file descriptors, or mostly empty file descriptors. The first problem. Second problem is, how do you decide what N is? N better be very large to accommodate most needs. Okay, DVD is like 4 to 6 gig in size. Okay, millions of sectors. Should you create a 1 million entry array for every block, every file? Probably not. Okay, that's going to waste a lot of space on this. So how do you come up with a better organization, okay, that will allow us to grow and shrink? So one suggestion was, you have to grow this structure dynamically. Okay, that is basically the one that we are going to pick, but we are going to grow it in a different way. Okay, so you already did the advantage and disadvantage. So rather than growing it in one layer, we are going to make the organization multi-level. We are going to be smart, because we want to support small and large files. We are going to treat them slightly differently. Okay, so this is what your multi-level index node looks like. This is basically what a traditional Unix file system does. Okay, whether you have ext2 or things like that. Okay. ext3 is a log structured as a log organization, which is slightly different, but until ext2, all file systems look like this. Okay, so this is your file descriptor. Okay. So it has, typically it has 14, so this has 14 entries. Okay. The first 10 entries are, or maybe even 9. Well, this one says different. Okay, so let's just go with this. They're slightly different across file systems. So if you have 14 block pointers, the first 12 entries here directly point to disk blocks. Okay, so the first 12 blocks, you just read the file descriptor, you read these addresses, and you're done. Okay? If your file grows to a 13th block, then what you're going to do is we are going to allocate another disk block that is an extension of the index node. Okay? So you basically store an entry, a pointer to this block, and this block will actually have pointers to disk block. Okay? This is called the first level indirect block. Okay? These are direct pointers. This is one level indirection. Okay? So this is basically a one level indirect. So this is basically, let's say, 512 bytes. So you can store maybe 500 or depending on the block size, up to 1,000 entries here. Okay? Now, if your file size grows to more than 1024 plus 12 blocks, okay, you will use the 14th entry here and you will allocate another disk block. And this will have two levels of indirection. So this will basically, you will allocate the first entry, which will be a second level indirect, and this will have pointers to data blocks. Okay. So it's a multi-level index. The first few blocks are direct pointers. Okay, the next 1024 blocks are one level indirect. The next 1024 square blocks are two level of indirection. Okay? Typically, file systems have a triple level indirect because even this is not sufficient. So you will have a 15th entry here. So if you grow beyond this size, you are going to have one more entry that points to an index block, that itself points to another index block, that points to yet another one. Three levels of indirection. So you may ask, why complicate it this way? What did we gain? Yes?
Accessing any random block, if that's roughly log time, log the size of the number of index files you have.
Okay, accessing something takes log times the number of levels. That's fine. My question was somewhat even simpler. Why have this complicated organization? Okay, are there better ones? Why not do what was suggested, which is just have a linked list of these point of these index nodes? Right? Why did we go about doing this? Yes, you have something.
Is it because so the system can expand the size of the hard drive?
Is it because the system can expand the size of the, well, we want to expand the size of the file.
Yes.
Okay, not necessarily the hard disk, but of the file, and we'll see why that this organization helps. Yes, you have something.
So this gives you a good compromise, because if you have a really small file, you're already set up and your file descriptor doesn't take up much space. And yet, if you have a really, really big file, if we were going to use a linked list of 14 pointer blocks, and I want the 2 millionth block of the file, in order to find the pointer to the 2 millionth block of the file, I'm going to have to go through a lot of 14 pointer blocks. By using this structure, you get it, like he said, in log instead of linear.
Right.
So you get much better performance with big files.
So this organization is trying to strike a compromise between providing good performance for small files and reasonable performance for large files. Okay? This is like doing progressive taxation. As files grow larger, you pay slightly more overhead. Just as you grow richer, you pay slightly more tax. Same kind of scenario. Okay? So if you have small files, the first 12 blocks are direct pointers. Okay? So until your file is less than or equal to 12 blocks in size, you have no real extra overhead. You just read the file descriptors and the addresses are right there, and you can just go and access any of those blocks sequentially or in random. Okay? If your file grows bigger than that, you pay an overhead, which is I have to read yet another block that stores the next 1024 addresses. Okay? So for files that are up to 1036 blocks in size, you actually have to read one level of indirection. You read the file descriptor, you need another index node, and then you read this address. File grows a little more than that, you go and basically start allocating one more block. Okay? And then as the file grows, you keep adding these blocks. Okay? Two levels of indirection. And then, as I said, in real file system, you have three level indirects. Okay? The third level of indirection, you have one more entry here that will basically have three levels of indirect. So as the file grows, you are going to have little more overhead, but the overhead is still not growing very substantial. You have to access at most 3 disk blocks here to get to the data block you care about. The file descriptor, the first level, the second level, and the data itself. In 3 disk IOs, you can get to any random block in this structure. At most 3 disk IOs. The file is smaller, then it is either 1 disk IO here, or this plus this, or some such thing. Okay, is that clear? Okay. And the other advantage is you don't need to know the file size a priori. This amount of disk space you allocate to the file descriptor also grows with the size of the file. Okay. So initially you will have only one file descriptor. Okay. As the file grows beyond the 12th block, you will have this sector and this sector allocated for the metadata. As you grow beyond this, you will have this, this and this, and maybe one of these, and so on and so forth. So you don't have to allocate this gigantic array up front with all sparse entries. The descriptor itself grows with the file. Yes.
Are we representing directories as file descriptors in this case?
Are we representing directories as file descriptors? As we will see, we haven't talked about what is in the file. You can actually, the file could be a real file or a directory. Every directory or a file will have an index node that will look exactly like this. Okay? If a directory grows, which means the number of entries in the directory grows, you will grow similarly. Okay, so the index node can handle directories, and directories are just special files that contain names of other files. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so what is the maximum file limit in this case? Yes.
So we only
As I said, in reality there's a third level, but let's just take this simple organization and say 2 levels. Yeah, so if you have a 2 level index, multi-level index. Yeah, in number of blocks.
So you ask what was the number of blocks? Or the
number of maximum number of blocks that can be in a file. Okay, so how many direct block pointers do we have? Direct block pointers, which are the pointers to direct data blocks. Okay, first level indirect.
24 more.
This one. Okay. That's 1024. Okay, let's say this is a 4 kilobyte block chunk. Each pointer takes, let's say, 4 bytes. Okay, and that's 1024. Okay, so. Okay, so let's say you use that up, then now you are in 2 level indirect. Okay, how many blocks more can you accommodate? How many addresses can you accommodate in this structure?
1024
square. Okay, and if you have a third level indirect, you will basically have 1024 cube. So if you just have this file descriptor which have 15 entries, you can store a maximum file size that's that large. Okay? That times the block size, that many bytes. Okay, and as you can imagine, that's large. So I mean, not that large, but it is large. Okay, so it was 2 gigabytes used to be the file limit for a reason. Okay, so you can accommodate fairly large files. Yet, performance for small files is very good. If you have 1-2 kilobyte files, you will have file descriptor with a couple of entries. Okay, and those will have very good performance. Okay. Linux file systems actually go one step further. If you have very small files that are less than 10 bytes in size, they don't even allocate a disk block. They actually store those contents here. Because if you create an empty file or a file with 1 byte in it, you actually store that data here. So you just read the file descriptor and the data is already there. Okay, that's an optimization. Okay, but mostly used only in Linux. Yes, question.
So when you need a file, if you know what the size is, you know which index
is true. Yes. So the way it would work is basically if I say that the question is how are you addressing the file. If I say go to block I, okay, you will basically say if I is less than or equal to 12, just look at one of these entries and you are done. Okay, so that's how you dereference blocks 1 through 12. If you have blocks 13 to 1036, Okay? You say go read up the 12th block or the 13th address that points to this block, go read that and then find whichever one you care about here, and that gives you the address dereference. If you have 1037 to 1024 square, then basically you go down this path. Okay, so you go read that, then you go read this, find the right entry here, you go read that, and so on. Okay, so random access is still fairly simple. Yeah, you know exactly where to go. Yeah, you might have to have at most 4 disk IOs to get to any block, which is still not that bad. Okay, much better than a linked list organization where you have to scan n blocks to get to the nth block. Okay, any other questions here? Okay. So, advantages we did all that already. Well, it's simple to implement. It's not that simple. Supports incremental file growth. Yes. Small files are efficiently supported. Yes. Indirect access is somewhat inefficient to very large files, but now it's growing at logarithmically, not linearly. Okay, so that's still not bad. Okay, so and there is going to be seeks are still going to be n seeks, okay, because you want to read n, blocks are scattered all over disk. Okay, so you're still going to, they're not contiguous, so you still have n seeks. Okay. File size is bounded, that's the bound depending on the number of indirects you have. Okay. So you could do some optimizations to improve performance further, and these optimizations are basically going to say when you try to allocate, although you are not constrained or required to allocate blocks contiguously, you try to do that to get better performance. Okay? If you want to allocate 2 blocks, try to find them close to, so such that they are close to one another on the physical disk. So in that case, if you try to read the file sequentially, you can read those blocks quickly. You don't have to have long seeks between blocks. Okay? So you have optimizations called extents where you allocate multiple blocks of the file all at once contiguously just to save on I/O performance. So you try to do this, and they are not required. If you do, if you have a highly fragmented disk, you can keep your data anywhere. But if you have a mostly empty disk, you can get good performance by clustering blocks of the file close to one another on a disk. Okay, that way, the number of seeks is actually going to be lower. So if you have this kind of a disk, so you store the blocks as close to one another, so when you seek from one to another, they are very small seeks, so you don't actually pay a high cost. So by clustering this data, you can actually get better performance. That's an optimization. That's not a requirement. Okay, so that's what the OS could do to get better performance. Okay, so we are going to skip this because we have to do the exam review. So I'll come back to the last couple of slides later. Okay, so we are going to switch gears and we're going to talk about the next exam. As I said, if some of you came in late, there is a sample exam on Moodle. Okay, go take a look. Material for the exam is deadlocks and memory management. Okay, that is lectures 10 through 15. Okay, memory management overflowed into the 16th lecture. So there are 2 slides in lecture 16. Yeah, I think actually maybe 3. Okay, the first 2 or 3 slides. That's just an overflow. I couldn't finish it. That's all. That's the last couple of slides on memory management. Don't forget that. Essentially, material is from lectures 10 to 15, but there is a tiny bit of overflow into lecture 16. So please take that into account as well. Okay? As the material, okay, same kind of arrangement as last time. Evening exam in this room starts at 7 on Thursday. Okay? 1.5 hours like before. Okay, closed book, closed notes. Okay, and as I said, there is no lecture on Thursday. I will have office hours. I'll send email about that. But let's do a review. Okay, so deadlocks. That's what you need to. This is all the stuff. So as I said, same strategy as last time would be advisable, which is start with the slides that I have. Make sure you know the material on the slides. Things that are not on the slides, but in the book, you don't have to worry about. Okay? So start with the material on the slide. There are some notes here provided. You look at the notes, then go look, review what is in the book, okay, to get a better understanding. Okay? Don't start reading chapter equivalent chapters in the book end to end. Probably you will read a lot of material that's not relevant for the exam. Okay? Maybe relevant to operating systems, but not for the test. Okay? Okay? All the concepts, just quick review, you need to know what is a deadlock, how does it differ from starvation. So it's a condition where a set of threads or processes are waiting on, wholesome resources are waiting on one another for other resources. Nobody can make progress. Okay? That's basically the definition of a deadlock. Okay, we looked at four necessary conditions for a deadlock. Okay, you need to know what those four conditions are. Okay? So, mutual exclusion, hold and wait, circular weight. There's a fourth one that I'm forgetting. I shouldn't answer this question, my sir. Yes, sir. What's the question? I'm going to post this material on the class webpage shortly. Okay, I wanted to do the review and then post it. Okay. So we did three kinds of techniques for dealing with deadlocks. Deadlock prevention, deadlock detection, deadlock avoidance. Okay. So we said in one case, and they vary in terms of what we are trying to achieve. The simplest thing is you put some constraints on how the applications are written or how they use resources and make one of the four necessary conditions false. If one of the four necessary conditions is false, there will never be a deadlock. That's guaranteed, so the system doesn't have to do anything. But that's one approach. The other two approaches involve don't put any restriction, but then try to deal with deadlocks at runtime. Okay? One says when as requests come in, we will check what requests are being asked for and see if that would result in a circular wait, and if so, we deny that request. Okay? That's called deadlock prevention. The last one says I will not do any checks even at runtime. We'll just let processes run, threads run as they want, and we will try to deal with deadlocks after they occur. So we'll wait for a deadlock to occur, we'll run some cycle detector and say here are some threads that are deadlocks, and we'll terminate them. Okay? So you can deal with deadlocks when you write the application, you can deal with deadlocks when you run the application, you can deal with deadlocks after your applications are deadlocked. Okay? So spectrum of techniques. You need to understand all the differences between all of those things. Okay? We looked at deadlock detection in more detail by looking at resource allocation graphs. Okay, these are graphs that tell you what threads exist in the system, what resources exist, which thread is holding what resources, and who has requested other resources. Okay? This graph gives you a good depiction of all the current state of the system, and typically you try to not allow requests that will result in cycles. Okay, so you want to ensure that cycles are not present, and that's a good way of ensuring that deadlocks will not occur. So if a request comes in and granting that request caused results in a circular the cycle because this is a directed graph, then you deny that request. Okay? That basically leads to the concept of a safe state. Safe state is one in which you know there is no deadlock and all the resource, all processes can finish execution. We looked at this algorithm called Banker's algorithm. Somewhat painful, but yet in a good general algorithm to figure out whether to grant a request or not, depending on whether the system state is safe or not. Painful to work out in the problem, not painful to implement. So we did all these exercises where I was talking about need matrix, allocation matrix, and I think I lost most of the class. That's why it was painful for me. It is part of the resource allocation graph. This is a general algorithm that deals with arbitrary instances of resources, etc. You don't actually have a graph. You just deal with things in terms of matrices. Right? So the graph is there. It's implicit. But you can just code that up so just by looking and manipulating matrices. Right? So that's basically the way you deal with the Banker's algorithm.
Would that be an avoidance? Banker's algorithm
is same as this one. Yeah, it's a generalization of this. Because these are all running at runtime. Requests come in, you say, should I grant this request or not? If I grant this request and you go to unsafe state, you may lead to a deadlock. Okay, this is a runtime algorithm, not something that runs after the fact. Okay. So that's deadlocks. And then we have a slew of lectures on memory management. So we studied all of these schemes, relocation, contiguous allocation, paging, segmentation, page segmentation, demand paging, and virtual memory. Okay? So you need to understand the whole spectrum of scheme. Okay, so I'm going to slice it and dice it slightly differently. Okay? So for each of those strategies, you need to understand how address translation works. Okay? Given a logical address, how is a physical address derived? What data structures are maintained? Whether they are base or limit registers, space tables, segment registers, what are these data structures, and how, and TLBs of course, and how do you do this translation efficiently? So, yes. As I have not set the exam, so I cannot say yes or no, but it is fair game, because address translation, you should understand how it works, whether it is a mathematical problem or a conceptual problem, you need to understand what it is. Okay, but yeah, so I think but it's good to know how it works. Hardware support needed is especially important. You need to know specifically the notion of a TLB, how it speeds up address translation. You need to understand how TLBs actually help. We did this analysis called effective memory access, which says if the TLB hit rate is a certain value, then those are, that's the fast path. You just look up the TLB, you're done. And if you get a TLB miss, you go to the actual page table in memory, and then you get this analysis of what is the effective memory access. You need to understand all of that. Okay? As far as contiguous policies are concerned, fragmentation is the issue. We need to understand what is fragmentation. How do all of these processes, not processes, strategies, which ones have fragmentations, which ones don't. Okay? So I think the ones that segmentation has fragmentation, and relocation and contiguous allocation have fragmentation. The rest don't. Okay? Anything that is paged will not have fragmentation. Okay? Ability to grow processes, share memory with other processes, ability to move processes, how do all of these schemes perform along these dimensions? Okay. What do you do for memory protection? Okay. Limit registers, out of range addresses in page tables, and so on and so forth. And context switches. Okay. What state needs to be saved and what state needs to be restored? Page tables, TLBs, and segment tables, that kind of stuff. Okay. So, okay, things should be able, that might answer your question. Given a request for memory, determine how it can be supported using contiguous allocation. Given virtual addresses, find the corresponding physical address. Okay, this kind of stuff you need to understand and how to do. Okay, that's what you are asking. Okay. So we will quickly review these policies. Contiguous allocation, we started with static and dynamic relocation. Okay. Static relocation just assumes that you basically stick the process in memory, it never moves, and typically it starts at address zero. Okay, you mostly use for uniprogramming. Okay. If you have multiple processes loaded in memory at the same time, you need to load the processes at different regions in memory and use a base and limit registers to do the address translation. So you take the logical address, which is with respect to the start of that process, okay, that's called an offset, and then you add it to the base register, that gives you the physical address. Okay, so that is basically how dynamic, that should be relocation, not allocation. Yeah, that's incorrect. So that's how dynamic relocation is going to do its address translation. Okay, so your base and limit register. As far as allocation strategies go, you're doing contiguous, so there's going to be fragmentation. And we said there are multiple ways to do this. You have holes which are free space in memory, so you can look for the best fit for a given process, the first fit for a given process, or the worst fit for a given process with respect to the size of the hole. Okay, so you need to know what these policies do. Okay, so that's a simple policy. The more complex ones involve paging or segmentation or combination of the two, segmented paging. Okay, so paging basically says you will allocate memory in fixed size chunks called pages. So you will take a process, chop it up into pages, take memory, chop it up into frames of the same size, and allocate pages to frames. You are no longer requiring that pages are stored contiguously. Okay, pages can be stored anywhere, so you are going to keep a table called a page table with pointers to memory. Okay. So as you see today, in today's class we looked at file descriptor. it was acting the same way as page table. That stores pointer to disk blocks, page table stores pointers to memory blocks. Okay, same deal. And in either case, do you have the process or the file to be contiguous. Okay. So we need to, talked about where are page tables stored. We said you could put it in registers, but you don't have enough of them, so typically not a good idea. Could store it in memory, okay, in kernel memory. And there it can, you can arbitrarily size page tables. Okay, but the problem is you have doubled the number of accesses to dereference a memory address. First have to go to the page table in memory, read it, and then you look at the page table entry and then you go to the page and read it. Okay, so you use a TLB to speed up these memory accesses. TLB is a cache for the page table, an associative cache for the page table. Okay, this is going to speed up your effective memory access time. Okay. So that's paging. Yeah, that's the paging in like 2 minutes. And then we talked about another scheme called segmentation. Okay, I think this is where lots of people were missing from the class. So be sure to go and review this material carefully. Segmentation is the compiler's view of a process. A process now doesn't have pages, it has segments. Code segment, text segment, heap segment. And you allocate memory for each of these segments independently. Okay? Segments can be of arbitrary size. So this is going to lead to the same fragmentation problem. Okay? But the way you dereference it, the addresses are segment ID and an offset within the segment, rather than a page number and an offset within the page. Yes?
You said it's a compiler's view?
Compiler or the processor's view, yes. So when a compiler generates machine code, it will assume that there is a code segment as a stack and a heap, and it's going to address the regions appropriately. Okay? The OS doesn't directly care. The OS only looks at the address space, so it's sort of really agnostic. Okay? Segment tables can also be stored in registers if you want, or base and limit registers particularly. Okay, so that's basically how you are going to. Yes?
So sorry to get back to that. Are the segment tables created by the compiler, or are they created by the operating system to refer to?
So the way we will do is the segment tables are created by the OS. Okay?
Okay.
Remember that the compiler always is going to generate a logical address, which is an integer. Which
right.
is basically, the compiler thinks of this as one layout. Okay, this may be the heap, this may be the stack, this may be the code segment. So it is just going to address it from zero down. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
When the OS is concerned, it will take this address, which is this integer, to a particular word here, and it will extract the segment ID and the offset by just looking at the integers.
That makes sense, but if the compiler is deciding where to put the segments within the logical memory space, the operating system that's deciding how to break it up into pieces, how does the operating system know where the compiler puts the segment boundaries?
How does the OS know where the segment boundaries? So the stack and the heap are going to grow dynamically.
Okay.
Heap, the compiler will not know anything about. It is just going to use pointers. They are going to get dereferenced at runtime.
Okay.
Right, so the heap is going to be dealt with completely at runtime. The stack you can actually figure out, because once you call a function, you allocate a new stack frame, okay, and then you say these are the three way parameters, this is the return value, so the stack is actually going to grow. So you can use the stack pointer and address the variables on the stack.
Okay.
Okay, so the compiler will have to generate appropriate addresses for parameters, for instance, that are actually going to be on the stack. It has to address them within the machine code. And it is going to use this view to address them. Compiler has to then not the compiler, the OS has to translate it at runtime into a particular segment, which is a stack and an offset in that segment. Okay? You may not know the exact sizes. That is dealt with by limit register. But you do know the offset, at least for the stack. The heap is going to be completely dynamic. But that's taking us into the realm of compilers, not necessarily OSs, of how compilers actually generate code and how they address variables and things like that. Okay, just as you said, these go into registers and this stay in stack and so on and so forth. Okay, that's a diagram. We don't have to know about what I just said here as far as OS is concerned, but it's a good thing to know that in order to understand segmentation better. Okay. So very quickly, we talked about combining segmentation and paging, because segmentation has external fragmentation. We said, why not page the segments? Okay, so now we have multiple data structures. There's a segment table, and there's a page table for every segment, and then page tables point to pages within that segment. Okay? And that basically allows you to retain the compiler's view of the process, which is all these segments, and the OS's view of the process, which is it doesn't care what is in it, it just wants to page them, because that's the way it avoids fragmentation. Okay? Demand paging is where basically the next scheme we looked at, and this is where we relax the assumption that the entire process be resident in RAM. We allow processes to, a single process to be bigger than RAM, and we also allow the total size of all the processes to far exceed the size of RAM. And we did this by using disk as a backing store for RAM. Okay? And that basically says we are going to fetch pages on demand from disk into RAM. Every time you touch a page that's not resident in memory, you get a page fault. Then you go into a page fault routine, and then you fetch the page and resume execution. So you need to know what a page fault is, how it is serviced, okay, how you resume execution. Okay, so then we talked about page replacement algorithms, because whenever a page comes in on a page fault, some page gets evicted. Okay, we looked at schemes to do this, FIFO, first come first serve, first in first out, min, which is an optimal policy. It actually requires knowledge of the future, so you evict the page that is going to be accessed the farthest in the future. Okay, optimal but not practical, okay, because you don't know the future. Okay, unless you are Oracle, which is not the company, but Oracle as in the, somebody who knows the future. Okay, so LRU is a policy that approximates mean by just looking at the recent past. Okay, you assume past is a good predictor of the future, and you look and evict the page that was accessed the farthest in time. Okay, and we spent an entire lecture that looked at implementation aspects of LRU. Okay, we said LRU sounds like a good policy, but it is notoriously difficult to implement. Okay, so we looked at various ways to implement LRU, and they were all very expensive. So we said we cannot actually implement this in practice with good performance. So we looked at approximation. We looked at two such approximations, second chance and enhanced second chance. Okay, we saw some other ones where you have fewer bits to approximate timestamps and so on. Okay. Second chance policy uses a one-bit stamp to partition pages into young and old, two groups, pages that are in use and pages that are old. And if you need to evict, you just go to the old group and you evict. And you use a single bit that you can actually store on either the page table or on the TLB to figure this out. Okay. So do go and review all of that material. That was another class where I think the attendance wasn't very good, but still good to be on the test. Okay, so as far as LRU is concerned, we talked about two kinds, global LRU per process. Okay, in global LRU, you take all the pages of all processes, put them on one single list, and you always evict the least recently used page. Okay, so processes are competing for memory. One process can evict another process's page. Okay, so you don't get memory isolation. But you can dynamically grow and shrink processes by evicting the appropriate pages. In per process, you basically always evict your own page. Your per process LRU list, to evict a page, you evict your least recently used page, not somebody else's page. Okay? And then we talked about thrashing and how do you do working set computations using temporal locality. Okay, we talked about spatial locality and temporal locality of reference in the context of the 90-10 rule. Okay, so you need to understand what 90-10 rule is, what is working, what is spatial and temporal locality. The last concept is, what is a working set? Okay, this is the set of pages the process is actively working on. The basic point is, if you are not even given enough memory to allocate, to accommodate your working set, the process is going to page fault a lot. Okay, so all memory allocation schemes must strive to at least give a process these many pages, that is working set size. And so that's basically it. So we talked about thrashing, and the last point was, how do you determine a page size? Okay, what happens for large pages, small pages? There's implications on the size of the page table and the overheads of page faults. Okay, the larger the pages, a single page fault gets amortized across more memory instructions. Okay, so you want to balance these trade-offs. As far as problems are concerned, we have done a sequence of these for replacement algorithms, given us a reference stream and some number of frames. You need to figure out what pages are resident in memory, what accesses lead to page fault, and so on. Okay. The last point I forget is we talked about this notion of Bernoulli's anomaly. Okay. This is a problem where if you increase the memory allocation of the process, it performs worse. As far as when you have techniques like FIFO, the page fault rate actually goes up rather than down. Okay, so you need to know what Bernoulli's anomaly is. So I'm going to stop. I'm a couple of minutes over the time limit here. So I will stop. As I said, I will have office hours tomorrow and Thursday. If you have questions on this, please come by.